Welcome everyone to the May session, as our 18th season of the Torah for Tycoons program continues. Thank you, as always, to the Harry H. Baron Trust and Rabbi Zev Baron for its continuous sponsorship of Torah for Tycoons as we continue our 18th season. Sorry, the lighting over here is a little bit messed up because of the light coming in through the window over here. A couple of announcements before we begin. So, first of all, I want to encourage all of you here to consider, as always, the Kolo's Life, Live on Life and Legacy program. And this initiative is organized here in Denver by Rose Community Foundation. It's helping the Kolo and many other Denver organizations create future financial stability through planned giving, like wills, estate planning, and endowments. Also want to mention again, although a lot of you have gotten emails about this new program that we began this week, our Gold Senior Division launched a new program yesterday, Tuesday, called the Live and Learn Program that takes place Tuesdays over here in the West Denver Kolo Torah Center. And this is a really great opportunity for those who are retired, semi-retired, who would like to join a great class and enjoy a great lunch as well. And that features two classes back to back with a few minute break in between. There's coffee, there's refreshments, there's a great lunch at the end. And that starts at 10:30 Tuesday mornings in West Denver at the Kolo Torah Center with lunch at 12:15. If you want more details, you can reach out to me or check out the Kolo website or reach out to the Kolo info at denverkolo.org. Also wanted to mention that the Kolo is in the planning stages of its annual, but on hiatus for the last 2 years because of COVID, pre-Shavuos Learnathon program. And that program is going to take place the Sunday before Shavuos. I believe it's May 29th. Details are still being worked out, but that is a great event for men and women. An hour of learning followed by a Siyum, and great refreshments at the end to celebrate the Siyum. That'll be the week before Shavuos as we get ready for Shavuos. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce this evening's presenter, Adam Oliver. Thank you, Adam, so much for being here this evening and for doing this class with me.
Hey, thank you so much, Rabbi Fleischer, and thank you, everyone, for attending. So I guess I'll start with, before everything else, nothing would be considered investment advice here. I just want to get that disclosure out of the way. Now, from there, let's start with this story. So imagine you get out of your Rolls Royce. You walk past those perfectly manicured bushes right at Central Park West, and you enter your skyscraper tower office. And you walk past the bull and the bear and the lobby, those big bronze statues, and you smile to yourself when you look at that bear. And then you enter that Gold Trim elevator, and as you're going up, you push button 70, check your Rolex, and you see it's only 9:15 in the morning. So 15 minutes before the stock market opens. Still plenty of time to check the ticker tape to see how your fund's doing. And as those elevator doors open, you walk out to that familiar hum of world-class computing power. And with that algorithm running, with all that computing power, you have the best traders in the world surrounding you. And from there, you walk into your office, your secretary hands you the tape saying, congratulations, the fund is now $5 billion. You have $5 billion invested into your fund. And then your Nobel Prize winning economist team turns to you and says, look, we've done it. We've beaten risk. We have the perfect strategy. And now we can just borrow more and more and more money. And with these tiny bets that can't fail, we'll just make more and more money. Everything's going to work out great. But then suddenly, and fitting for today's terms, there's crisis out of Russia. A currency crisis. So all of a sudden, your $5 billion turns into $4. You know, they check the algorithms, a kolbeseder. Everything's fine. Everything's going to be okay. That is until every other bank on Wall Street realizes that behind that $5 billion is $120 billion of debt. All of a sudden, nobody will trade with you. Your accounts are frozen. All those small bets become huge bets, and that $4 billion turns into $1, turns into -$4. And the next thing you know, you have the federal government coming in to shut down your firm and to keep worldwide financial contagion from breaking out. Now, this is the story of a firm called Long-Term Capital Management. In 1998, as described in the book aptly called When Genius Failed. So when we think about this idea of Gestapos, of our due diligence, of making investments and considering risky assets, what can we do when the Super Bowl of advisors, every resource available, when those guys got something terribly wrong? What can we learn from them? So there's a few key principles I'd like to talk about. And the first big one is relying on other people. So for me, I started my career working for the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, as an auditor and a regulator. So that meant I would walk into a bank, and if there was a sign posted on the wall that said, we're paying you 2% on your savings account, I was the lucky guy at 22 years old who would go in and make sure that your account was actually earning a 2% rate. And we see a similar idea when it comes to investing in the stock market. Since the Enron, MCI WorldCom, and some of that fallout, every company is required to have an independent auditor who gives an opinion on the reliability of that information. And another way we can really rely on other people is when it comes to a trusted advisor. Say you're looking to buy a piece of real estate, and maybe it's a fixer-upper, or maybe there's a lead paint issue, or there's a termite issue. You may have someone that you know who can rely upon, who can help figure out how much this is going to cost, what pieces are going to need to come into this in order to make it a worthwhile investment. And I would say this is a huge topic and a huge issue in the financial services industry. There's something called the fiduciary standard, which shockingly few advisors are held to. A fiduciary standard means the person giving you financial advice has to put your best interest first before theirs. A lot of firms operate from what's called a suitability standard, which means the advisor can get a huge commission. And just so long as it's okay, just as long as it's generally suitable for you, then that's a reasonable investment. So the role that other people and getting the right other people involved can really help in our Gestapos, in our due diligence practice process. Another big topic is transparency. When it comes to the stock market, for example, it's a great example of this transparency. When you have millions or even billions of shares of stock being traded, it becomes very easy when a friend comes to you and says, hey, do you want to buy my shares of Apple? I'll give them to you for $500. All he has to do is type in a few quick numbers and realize that that stock is trading for about half that amount. So the stock market is this great example of that transparency. And the same thing happens in the real estate market. Any home bought or sold is then recorded to the county. So in order to get a loan and to buy a house, there's this appraisal that gives other sales in the area of recent time. And that comes out, is the price you're paying reasonable? Is it within that kind of range? So there's that transparency in prices. And this comes in stark contrast to say your cousin's startup business that he wants you to invest in, or when you're visiting Yerushalayim and there's that shop right off the shuk where you can get that Rolex for a great deal. Some of those types of investments, or Bitcoin, we can include in that as well. We can get to a little bit more later. There's no way of knowing the value of some of those types of investments. Now, when we think about valuing an asset, how do we think about what is this asset worth? And from there, we can look at a spectrum. On one side, and getting to our headline here of bonds, ORDO, and then on the farther side, Bitcoin. When you think of a value of an asset, a bond is about as straightforward as you can get. I'm giving you money today for more money in the future, all else equal. So I give you $100 today, you give me $11 every year for the next 10 years, you're giving me back $110 over the next 10 years. Very clear to understand the value of that investment. And when it comes to something like Bordeaux, we know that fine wines, like a good kosher French Bordeaux, will increase in value over time. But how much will it increase? Will that bottle go from $10 and increase by another $10 in 30 years? Or will it increase by $10,000? There's really no way to know how much that wine will increase, but we know that there's some basis for that increase. And then when we look at an asset like Bitcoin, there's really no underlying reason it would increase in value. The only asset value it has in and of itself is what other people will pay for it, this idea of scarcity. And while there might be great underlying technology, maybe a talk for another Torah for Tycoons about that technology for someone much more informed than me, this idea of when it comes to Bitcoin, there's no asset generated, there's no cash generated from it. So the value of it could be $40,000 like it is today, that could grow to $1 million, it could go to zero. There's really no way to know. So in summary, when we think about some of those core factors of our hishtadlus that we need to do, we consider our understanding, consider value of other people, getting the right people involved, this idea of transparency, and then is there a reliable value of these assets? So another big topic in this area is that of risk. And one of the core ideas of risk is what's called, and I would say for income-producing assets like stocks or bonds, or maybe include Bordeaux, is the idea of this trade-off between risk and reward. On one far side of that spectrum, you have something like your savings account, which today might be all the way up to 0.5% that you earn on that. And on the far other side, you could be investing in the hot new technology startup out of Israel. The savings account might earn 0.5 or 1%, and that Israeli tech company might earn 50% or 100% is what you could expect on that. When it comes to that savings account, you know it's backed by the bank, and the bank is backed by the FDIC, my former employer. And then even if that huge fund, insurance fund, dried up, the federal government is there to ultimately have your back. But then when it comes to that Israeli startup company, the value could be anything from nothing, or the technology could become incredibly worthwhile, and it could be a $1 billion company. So then the big question is, the people investing in those, if you're putting $1 million in this Israeli startup company, how do they justify that with such a high level of risk? And really, the answer to this comes through the idea of diversification. Just like for the venture capital firm, they're looking for rocket ships, and so they're going to light a whole bunch of fuses, knowing that most of those will be duds and land flat, but maybe one goes to the moon. If they invest $100 million between 100 different companies, maybe one will be worth $1 billion, which totally justifies the other 99 that end up with no value at all. And this is something we can think about our own investments as well. See, if you go back 6 years ago and you invest in a paragon of the prior, really century, General Electric, in the last 6 years, General Electric stock has gone from, if you had $1,000, you'd have about $350 today. And on the other side, if you invested in Amazon at that same time, you would go from 1,000 to about 2,000, double your money plus a little bit more. Whereas if you look at the S&P 500, the 500 largest companies in the US, that your $1,000 would have grown to about 1,700. So by getting this broad portfolio, by having that diversification, the losers get eliminated over time. Say General Electric might fall out of the S&P 500. Maybe it'll no longer be a company in the future, or maybe it'll recover, who knows. But then you get to participate in the upside of that Apple, the Amazon, the Tesla, and those stocks that continue to rise. So a big idea, this risk-reward trade-off and the this diversification. And one other core idea that I want to touch on comes from a few parachuters from the prior generation. So Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, when they weren't jumping out of airplanes to serve in the IDF, actually left their professor jobs in the U.S. to come back and serve in the IDF during the Seven-Day War. They really pioneered this field called behavioral finance. And basically what they learned is that while the stock market might go up and up and up, the returns that we as individuals get turn out to be much lower than that. If you look from the 1990s to 2020, they earn about two-thirds of the returns. So if your money grew from 100,000 to, say, 350,000, the average individual, their money might only grow to 220,000. And they said, what is the reason for that? The reason is because we might treat our money like a bar of soap. And you think about a bar of soap, the more you handle it, the less soap you have. And when it comes to our investments, rather than letting them stay put, letting them grow, letting this diversification, this risk reward work for us, we want to make changes. We panic when, say, Russia invades Ukraine and we sell our stocks, or when there's a global pandemic 2 years ago, or even when Y2K comes. We have those moments, we panic, we end up buying, we end up selling at the wrong times. And then when things are really, really good, we want to get under the action and we end up buying high. So we end up buying high and selling low. So in summary, when we have this story of long-term capital management, while we can't eliminate risk, we have to face these trade-offs. We have to diversify our money. We really need to know ourselves in the process as well and how to handle that money. So in closing, there's doing our Hashtadlus, there's preparing, making these investments, but aren't there times where we just need to go for it? Aren't there other reasons to invest rather than just understanding this risk and reward trade-off? And I'd say there's two big areas where it can make a lot of sense to invest, even when we don't have this full Hashtadlus and we're not able to totally do our homework. And the first big one is in cases where it generates interest. Say you believe that Bitcoin is going to change the world. By buying some Bitcoin, it gets you really interested in what it's doing in the future. You're learning about it. You're talking about it. By having that ownership, it's creating this interest. Or say you have children or grandchildren that you want to teach them the value of investing. It could be a perfect opportunity to buy them a few shares of, say, Apple stock, and they can compare that device that's in their hand to now being an owner of this company. And a third, say you're like Rabbi Fleischer and you're really interested in the future of hats and you want to know the different bill shapes and sizes. So you buy shares of Borsellino to really support that company and to understand and to be up to date on everything that's happening in the hat world. And one other area is that investing, even if you don't have this full Hashtadlus, is it aligns incentives. A lot of companies will offer stock options, or another thing is an employee purchase program. You can buy shares of your company stock. And say you're not sure how well your company is performing, you're not an expert in investing, by owning those shares, you're motivated as an employee, of course, to get your paycheck, then you're also motivated with the long-term success of your company. And one other example, let's just say someday, maybe in the future, please God, someone would consider opening a kosher dairy breakfast lunch restaurant in the Denver area. Say someday that were to happen, were to have that, then the owner came to you, you want to make an investment. Say you're not sure how viable it is, how well it's run, but then you're incredibly motivated to go to the restaurant, to buy gift cards for your friends and really build community in that way. So with that, I want to thank you for coming today. May we all make wise investment decisions, understand our risk-reward trade-offs, and as we continue to earn these profits and make great investment decisions, support and give generous tzedakah to the Denver Community Kollel, our Torah learning engine here in the Rocky Mountains.
Thank you very much, Adam. That plug was not planned, just for the record. and there are also many other worthy Jewish causes in Denver as well. Torah learning and charitable and so on as well. But thank you very much, Adam. Before I start talking, because as those of you who have been on here in the past know, once I start talking, I don't stop so fast. So if there are any questions for Adam before I start, now's everyone's big chance. I did mute everyone, so you have to unmute yourself if you wanted to do that. No? Okay. So then, just give me a moment. Let me just share my screen over here. And then we'll get started. There we go. Okay. Can everyone see that shared screen on my sources over there? Okay. All right, Marsha, I hope it's big enough for you. You can just give me a thumbs up if you want. Okay, so good, thank you. So as Adam discussed, a major part over here of our discussion is what we call Hashtadlus. Hashtadlus means effort. Specifically in our context, it is coming off of the obligation that we have to put in the necessary effort to earn a living. Ever since Adam and Eve ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil in the Garden of Eden, they were subjected to the curse of by the sweat of your brow, you shall eat bread, which means that we have to put in the effort to be able to earn a living. Some people need to put in more effort. Some people need to put in less effort. Some people are born with a silver spoon in their mouth. Some people are, will never see a silver spoon in their entire life. But we are obligated to put in our effort. And when we talk about, it's pretty straight. I mean, I shouldn't say pretty straightforward. How much effort to invest in making a living is a very complex topic, and we'll touch on it somewhat tonight. But in our, the context of our discussion, as Adam mentioned, the risk versus reward when you're investing in things and so on, the question becomes, what is a reasonable amount of hishtadlus, of effort to put into something regarding investing? What kind of risk versus reward ratio am I looking at in the context of that is fulfilling my obligation of putting in an effort? When is it not considered putting in an effort? When is it considered being ridiculous or reckless or negligent or things like that? So we're going to try to touch on a few ideas over here as we move forward. In the first number of sources are going to focus on some different approaches of effort, and we'll try to apply that to our conversation. And then we'll try to see a few sources that zero in a little bit more on, shall we say, perhaps Talmudic investment advice. Okay, if you think you're gonna find anything about Bitcoin in these sources, you've got something else coming. You won't find anything explicit about Bitcoin, even though it is worthwhile to just recall the story of there were some British archaeologists who were digging in Britain, and they dug some 100 feet down, and they discovered some telephone wires. And so they announced to the world that, look at that, we dug and dug, and based on how deeply we dug and based on the surrounding soil and items, these telephone wires were around at least 1,000 years ago. This is a testament to British technological advancement that in Britain they already had telephones 1,000 years ago. So the French, not to be outdone, immediately began an archaeological dig, and they dig and dig and dig, and they dig some 200 feet down, and they discover telephone wires. And they say, based on our dating and our best estimate, we believe that these telephone wires were here 1,500 years ago. So we are far ahead of the British in terms of technological advances. We already had telephones 1,500 years ago. So the Israelis immediately began an archaeological dig, and they dig and they dig and they dig, and they find and they dig some more, and they dig some more, and they find all sorts of stuff, pottery and wells and cisterns and mikvahs and houses, but no telephone wires. And after digging for some 6 months, the Israeli archaeologists come and they call a news conference, and they say, we are so advanced, we had cell phones back then, we didn't need any telephone wires. So but that said, the fact of the matter is that you're not going to find really much of modern day investment complications, shall we say, in the Talmud. But like I said, we can always look at what the Torah has to teach us and try to apply those lessons to our modern world. So here we go. Fortunate is the person, source number one, fortunate is the person who places his trust in God, says the Medrash, Bereishis Rabbah, this is Yosef. And he does not turn to the haughty. This is a verse in Psalms. Fortunate is the person who places his trust in God. This is a reference to Yosef. Joseph, and he does not turn to the haughty, for through his saying to the butler, only that you remember me and mention me. Two words in the Torah, the two words that Joseph told the butler when he was in prison. You may recall, Joseph is in prison after being falsely accused of trying to assault his master, Potiphar's wife. She, in fact, was trying to seduce him. He fled. She accused him of trying to assault her, and he is thrown into prison. And then, of course, there's the whole story with the dreams of the butler and the baker, and Joseph interprets their dreams, and he tells the butler, you are going to be released from prison in a short time. And he says, Zichartani v'hizkartani, please remember me and mention me to Pharaoh. And says the Medrash, for those two words that Joseph said, Zichartani v'hizkartani, which translate to the much lengthier English, only that you remember me and mention me, 2 years were added to his prison sentence. For those two words, he got 2 more years. For saying those two words. So all the commentators ask the following question, and they say, I don't understand. Why is Yosef being taken to task for saying two words to the butler to please mention him to Pharaoh to get him out of prison? What happened to the idea of hishtadlus? We are obligated, one is obligated, to put an effort. Doesn't it seem logical that if God arranged this whole situation with being met with the butler and the baker in prison, and they have these dreams, and they ask him for an interpretation, and Joseph interprets it, and he's pretty confident that he is interpreting those dreams correctly, it seems very logical to say that he should ask the butler to please do something to get him out of prison. What did Joseph do wrong? Okay. Furthermore, they ask, if Joseph failed, why is he being referred to as the person who places his trust in God? Seemingly, he is not the person who places his trust in God. That seems to be the criticism. So the different answers to this question kind of create an interesting panorama of views of what our obligation is when it comes to investing effort. Okay, so the first and perhaps the most well-known in the yeshiva world, shall we say, in the Torah world of approaches is that of the Beis Halevi, Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, who was one of the great Torah leaders and authorities of the 19th century. He was, what one can say, the founder of what is known today as the Brisk Dynasty. If you've heard of the Soloveitchik Brisk Dynasty, both in Israel and America, across the world, he was the progenitor, the founder of that dynasty. And he has a lengthy piece over here, and I'm just going to share with you a few lines from that lengthy piece, where he says as follows. The amount of effort that is pleasing, meaning pleasing to God, is not equal for all people. One who can reach a point of trust with minimal work, when he increases his effort more than is necessary for him, it is a sin in regard to the trait of trust. This word trust is in Hebrew known as bitachon, trust in God. And so the Beis Halevi, Rabbi Soloveitchik, says that it depends where you're at spiritually. A person who is very advanced in his spiritual development, who has developed a very high level of trust in God, needs to invest less effort and should invest less effort. A person who is less spiritually developed has to invest more effort. Basically, the more advanced you are regarding trust, the less you need to do. If you want to give a very basic comparison for this, if you're a manager in a company and you have someone who works under you, whom you assign a project to or a task, if you the higher level trust you have in that person under you who's on your team, the less you have to get involved because you have a high level of trust. The more you stick your nose into his business, the less confident he's going to get, the less he's going to feel like he should go ahead and get it done on his own, and the more he's going to rely on you to make sure that all the I's are dotted and all the T's are crossed and so on. And so the more you get involved, the less he will do. And the more trust you put in him and you build that trust, the more likely it is that, assuming that he's a trustworthy employee, obviously, the more likely it is that he will return that trust by coming through on his own. So if we can flip that around with our relationship to God, the more trust we build in Hashem, in God, that he will take care of us, the less we need to do from our end in order to make sure that we get what we need in order to be able to live, to make a living, to earn a livelihood for our needs to be provided. And just to cap off his approach, he says that Yosef was this person who places his trust in God. Yosef was a very advanced level of trust in God. That's very clear when he stands before Pharaoh. He tells Pharaoh, nothing is up to me. Everything is up to God. He says, I'm not the one interpreting your dreams. God is the one who's interpreting your dreams. I'm just his mouthpiece. So Yosef is clearly putting his trust in God. And therefore, at his level, it was inappropriate to even say those two words. It was too much effort to even say those two words. Because at his level, he shouldn't have said those two words. Some authorities, I didn't quote here, say one word would have been enough. He said two. One word would have sufficed. He said two words. That was two words too many. If he would have said one word, that would have been enough. Because he said two words, the whole thing was no good, and he got an extra 2 years in prison for those two words. But the upshot of the Beis Halevi's approach is that the amount of effort, or if we could, that a person has to invest in his hishtadlus, in trying to make a living, is inversely proportionate with his level of trust in Hashem. The higher the level of trust, the less effort he should be investing. If we apply this, you know, to a stock market kind of situation, how much due diligence should one have to do and so on and so forth, how much homework and so on? Well, that would really depend on the person's level of trust in Hashem. But we'll talk more and get more into details after we see the other approaches, and we'll try just to summarize, based on the different approaches, what each one would say in the context of different risk versus reward scenarios. Source number three is the Chazon Ish, Rabbi Avraham Yishai Karelitz, who was the leader of Torah Jewry in the land of Israel from the mid-1930s when he emigrated, when he moved to the land of Israel from Europe until his death in the early 1950s. The Chazon Ish, in a work called Emunah Bitachon, where he talks about different areas of trust and faith in God, he gives a different approach. He says as follows. He says, because a person is obligated to do actions and not rely on a miracle, Yosef obligated himself to utilize this opportunity and to request from the butler. So says the Chazon Ish, in fact, Yosef was obligated to go ahead and to do something with this opportunity. He cannot just rely on miracles and sit around and wait to be released. He has an opportunity. He has to utilize it. However, since in the personality of the Hori, it is not his nature to remember and do good for others, this deed of Yosef was, it should be not fitting, except as an act of desperation. Says the Chazon Ish, that if we go back to our original verse, our original Medrash, it says, fortunate is the person who places his trust in God. He does not turn to the Hori. Who's the Hori? The Hori is this butler who is a very haughty person. Again, I'm not going into all the details right now, but Rashi in his commentary makes a number of points to show that this butler was not winning the Mr. Nice Guy Award of the year, but he was a haughty, self-centered individual. Even when he finally later, 2 years later, mentioned Joseph to Pharaoh, he does it in a very demeaning fashion. Okay, and he makes sure that even though he's trying to ingratiate himself with Pharaoh and to find him a solution for his problem of his dreams, but he makes sure to knock Yosef down in describing him and to demean him as much as possible. So this butler is a haughty person. That being the case, the verse is telling us turning to the haughty is not considered an act of effort at all. It's an act of desperation. And if it's an act of desperation, then it's not appropriate to do that at all. That's not called effort. That's what we would call in English grasping at straws. And grasping at straws means, continues the Chazon Ish, that you're not really trusting in God. Who grasps at straws? A desperate person, right? The expression, grasping at straws, is a drowning man in a body of water who is just trying anything to save himself, grasps at straws. It's an exercise in futility. It's just that there's nothing else to do. The person is so helpless that he's just grasping at a straw, which is not going to help him. A person who truly trusts in God will not grasp at straws. He will trust in God. Ergo, he is obligated to put in effort, but that effort is, I have to do something, but I'm trusting that God will take care of me. Yes, God, Hashem, wants me to do something. He wants me to do my part, but once I've done my part, I sit back and I trust that Hashem will take care of things. And therefore, Yosef going ahead and asking this haughty person to help him is viewed as an act of desperation. And an act of desperation is not appropriate. Okay, that is approach number two from the Chazon Ish. A couple more sources here, and then we'll try to just to summarize and see what we have. Source number four. This is a passage from Rabbi Elio Dessler, one of the great Musar thinkers of the last generation. Two generations ago, he passed away in the mid 1950s. In his work Michtav Elio, he cites the great Rabbi Zundel of Salant. If you've ever heard of Rabbi Yisrael of Salant, who was the founder of the Musar movement. His teacher, his Rebbe, who inspired him to found this movement, was Rabbi Zundel of Salant. He was known to be an extremely pious individual. And Rabbi Dessler quotes Rabbi Zundel of Salant as saying the following idea. One must engage in ishtadlus, in effort, only because we are not fit to experience open miracles. That is the fallout from Adam and Eve eating from that tree of knowledge in the Garden of Eden. And so we are obligated to do things to do things in a way that the bestowal that God bestows upon us, that descends to us from heaven, can be tied to some sort of natural cause. In other words, he's saying that post sin of the Garden of Eden, our livelihood has to be provided in a natural fashion. We cannot rely on miracles. We cannot expect God to provide for us miraculously. With the exception of the Jews in the desert with the manna, in general, we cannot expect God to provide for us in a supernatural way. There has to be a natural course of events. That being the case, we have to put an effort. But that being the case, the required amount of effort is fulfilled through the most minimal degree of effort, such that one can erroneously attribute it to a natural cause. Says Rabbi Salon that really whenever we make our livelihood, what we're trying to do is really attribute all of our success, whatever we get, to Hashem himself bestowing us, not to my prowess in the market, not to my expertise, not to my talents, not to my uncanny ability to pick the stock that's going to go up or to figure out whether Tesla will ultimately succeed in sending rockets to the moon. I'm sorry, not Tesla, SpaceX. Will succeed in sending rockets to the moon, whether Bitcoin will ultimately be successful, and so on. No. It's coming from Hashem. However, we have to do something natural to be able to say that it looks like this came about in a natural sense. That is how God wants the world to run. And therefore, he says, in an ideal situation, ideally, one should just put in a token effort so that you could say, oh, I made a living. My livelihood is provided because XYZ happened through a natural event. And Rabbi Dessler goes on quoting Rabbi Zundel Salant saying that for him, Rabbi Salant said that for him, buying a lottery ticket, they had these lotteries of sorts back in Europe back in the day as well. They probably didn't have as much money in them as the Powerball has today. But Rabbi Zundel Salant said, for me, it would suffice to buy a lottery ticket. And that's enough. That's enough effort. That is sufficient effort. Okay, so says Rabbi Zundel Salant. So one more source, again, from Rabbi Dessler, continuing along in that passage. And Rabbi Dessler says this balance between effort and trusting in God must be with great precision and much exactitude. If one expends too much effort based on his level of faith, he will deny that it comes from above. And if he does too little according to his level, he will regret his earlier actions, will say, I should have done more, and also end up in a state of denial of divine guidance. It's dangerous. If you do too much, if you do too much based on your level of faith, then you will deny that it comes from God. You will attribute the success to yourself. If you do too little, you're going to say, you see, I only did a little bit and God didn't take care of me. One has to ascertain where is my level of faith of trust in God and put in that amount of effort. So having seen these sources, I want to now stop for a minute or two or three or five, and just analyze what these different approaches mean practically. I can't speak to every single line of work, but let's try to talk about the stock market and some of the different scenarios that Adam discussed in terms of risk versus reward. If we take the Beis Halevi's approach, which seems to be echoed to some degree by Rabbi Zundel Salam, perhaps from a different angle, okay, but a very similar approach, the idea is that the higher level of spiritual development you've achieved, that you have a very high level of trust in God, the less effort you have to put in. That being the case, Rabbi Zundel of Salant is willing to say that for someone of his level, buying a lottery ticket is sufficient. So that being the case, if Rabbi Zundel of Salant were to be alive today in 2022, and I were to give him, let's just say, $10,000 to invest in the market, I would imagine he would say, I'm not asking anyone, I'm not doing any homework, I'm not going to check anything. I am just going to blindly stick my finger on a listing of stocks, and whichever one my finger sticks on, I'll just buy that. And that's my effort. And not much else matters. Because his point is, you just have to make a token effort. That is his level. However, that might be true for Rabbi Zundel Salant, who is a very spiritually developed individual. But what about someone like me, who is ever so slightly less spiritually developed, okay? And, who spends a lot of hours, working and trying to make a living and this and that. And I think, present company excluded, of course, most people, have to put in a 9-to-5 day or something similar to be able to make a living. And it's, for most people to say that they would be willing to just buy a lottery ticket and then sit back and wait for the winning numbers that they chose to be drawn would be delusional. They are kidding themselves. Just to illustrate, the story is said with Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, Rabbi Zundel of Salant's student, and like I said before, the founder of the Muslim movement. He taught this idea of faith to his students, and he said that if a person is truly on the level of full trust in God, you could just buy a lottery ticket and just wait to win it, and you'll be fine. So one of his students indeed went ahead and bought a ticket for a lottery in whatever town he lived in. And he came back to his Rebbe, to Rabbi Salanter, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, and he said, okay, Rebbe, I bought the ticket, and now I'm just going to sit back and wait for my, you know, for my ticket to be drawn. I'm just going to wait to win. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said to him, you know, considering that you have the winning ticket, I want to make you an offer. I'll offer you, and he offered him a nice sum of money to buy the ticket off of you. Okay, a lot more than this student had paid for it. A nice, generous sum of money. And the student said, you know, that's a good offer. Fine, I'm going to sell it to you. So Rabbi Salanter said, you're a faker. You're kidding yourself. If you are certain you're going to win that lottery, you wouldn't sell it to me for anything short than the full value of the lottery that you're going to win next week. The very fact that you are agreeing to sell me this ticket for anything less than the full amount of money that you think you're going to win next week shows you don't truly believe you're going to win, which means you are just deluding yourself. And so for the vast majority of people, the reality is we have to put in effort that is on par with what most of the world considers normal effort. Rabbi Shimshon Pinkus, who was a great Torah authority, who died young, who was killed in a car crash in, I believe, the year 2000, either 1999 or 2000, was a great Jewish thinker, a great Torah leader. I heard him on a recording say that for the average person, the average proper effort is what is considered a normal amount of effort to put in. And that being the case, when it comes to stocks, that would be the same thing as Adam discussed. You have to do your homework, ask people who know what they're talking about, put in your due diligence, simply throwing money at the market and saying, okay, I put in my effort. I spent 10 minutes asking around. I looked at a couple websites that promised, that this expert predicted the last 18 stocks that went through the roof or whatever other clickbait pops up on your screen. And that's what I'm following. And that's my appropriate effort. That's enough. I will just share briefly a personal experience. I came of age, shall we say, during the dot-com boom of the late 90s. And I, being born in 1980, so I was around 20 years old during that period. And seeing that everyone was investing in the stock market, and I had I had some money sitting in a bank account, not doing much. So I opened up an account with TD Ameritrade, with what was then just Ameritrade. And I put a couple thousand dollars into the market. My father, who works for a company associated with the stock market, he asked around and got some tips. And I invested in a few stocks that I didn't even know what they did, leave alone whether they are good stocks or not. I think I put in about $2,000. And, being very excited, I checked them daily, sometimes more than daily. And, they went up, they went down. It was nice for a few years. I don't know if I really made money, lost money. But the point I'm making is that is not really hishtadlus. That is just, as Adam pointed out, everyone's jumping onto the bandwagon. Let me jump on the bandwagon as well. That can't really be called proper effort. That's just, I'm feeling left out and everyone else is jumping on. I didn't really do research. I didn't really do any due diligence. That wouldn't really be an appropriate way to try to make a living. Okay. If we have time, we'll try to talk about, can I just throw, if I have some extra money to spend, can I take a high risk or minimal effort venture just to see if it goes anywhere? That's a fair question, which I don't think Adam, if you want to weigh in on that question, let's say I'm Elon Musk and I have a few extra billion dollars to spare, or Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates or Melinda Gates, for that matter, is it appropriate to just, let me throw some money at something, even though it's high risk because I can afford it?
This is a conversation we honestly have often with our clients who say they want to invest in something like Bitcoin. And we'll talk about it in the term of fun money. I mean, in the same way, if you want to go to Las Vegas and gamble for entertainment, maybe Elon Musk gambling is $1 billion, but that maybe that's the equivalent of my, $4.99 that I'm taking to the casino or to the penny slot. So sure, so long as it's within the framework of your core money safe and your goals are accomplished, then speculation, why not?
So if I'm understanding, you're saying that basically it would boil down to more like an entertainment fun kind of involvement rather than a business kind of decision is what it would boil down to. So, whatever whatever would be reasonable for a person of my particular financial stature to spend on a on some entertainment, that would be reasonable to invest. But in terms of putting an effort, that would be a hard sell. Okay, I'll take that as acquiescence.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Sure.
All right, before I go on, and I do want to analyze this from the other side, from the Chazon Ish side. Before I go on, anyone have any questions or comments? Okay, got a loud crowd tonight. All right, so let me move on now. So again, from the vantage point of the Beis HaLevi, from the vantage point of Rabbi Zundel Salam, the amount of effort one puts in depends on where one is at in terms of his spiritual development. And as I said, for most of the world today, people work on developing their trust in God and so on, but most people cannot make the claim that they truly trust in God to the extent that they can buy a lottery ticket. Now, there's a lot of room between buying a lottery ticket and spending, endless time or hours and hours on every single investment you're going to make. There's a lot of room in between those two, and so it might be a little hard to ascertain exactly where you fall in on that spectrum. But in a general sense, for most people, within the realm of what's normal, in terms of due diligence, what would be considered normal? And you can ask, like someone like an Adam Oliver or, someone who knows what's going on in the market to understand what is considered reasonable due diligence, or you can give your money to a reliable, perhaps, investment firm and have them invest it with you, for you on your behalf. Make sure they are reliable. If their last name is Madoff, stay away. But that, I think, would be considered normal. According to the Chazon Ish, though, there's a very different viewpoint. The Chazon Ish is saying that you are obligated to put an effort and you cannot rely on the miracle. Yosef, therefore, obligated himself to utilize his opportunity and to request from the butler. So the Chazon Ish is saying that, in fact, Yosef did have to put in that effort. Yosef's failure was that what he did was not considered effort. It was considered an act of desperation. The Chazon Ish would take the view that for any person out there, you have to put in what would be considered a reasonable amount of effort. And even if you're on a very high level of trust, even if you're a Joseph whose level of trust in God is very high and is very developed and is very strong, you still have to put in reasonable effort despite your very high level of trust. And so according to the Chazon Ish, it would not be reasonable to go ahead and purchase a lottery ticket and rely on God to give you the money. It would not be reasonable for a person, even like Joseph, to invest in, let's say, a penny stock or something of that sort where it's high risk and perhaps there is great potential for a reward. But does someone trying to make a living reasonably invest in a penny stock? I don't think so. If I'm wrong on that, Adam, you can speak up. But that's my understanding, and that's maybe why they're called penny stocks. They're not worth very much. They're very high risk. Go ahead.
Well, just going back to that diversification. If you put all your money in one penny stock, very different than if you buy 1,000 different penny stocks. Then there may be basis to consider that.
Okay, fair enough. All right. So again, as you said, if you have that right diversification and you're putting into that, it's reasonable and makes sense. But according to the Chazon Ish's approach, one would have to put in, to put in something which would be looked at as an act of desperation, that would not be appropriate. Now, something like Bitcoin, which I don't think you could call investing in Bitcoin an act of desperation, but at the same time, as you said, to go ahead and invest solely in Bitcoin would probably be looked at as a not very, very reasonable action. I think that this approach would frown on that, to have Bitcoin as part of a diversified portfolio where, again, you are managing the risk versus reward through that diversification, that would be reasonable. The bottom line, I think that we can walk away with over here is that, practically speaking, for the average person today, both according to the Chazon Ish's approach and according to the Beis HaLevi's approach, when it comes to playing the stock market, you have to do your due diligence. The only real practical difference between these two approaches is for a person who is more spiritually developed, who has developed a high level of trust in God. So there may be room for that person to perhaps make a more wild, higher risk investment, because he's saying, that's my effort. I'm not doing more than that. And God will carry me the rest of the way. And God will take care of me. But for the vast majority of humanity, they can't honestly say that they've reached that level of trusting God to be able to put in that minimal, that little effort. Okay? So having discussed that, I want to touch on just with the 10 minutes, 9 minutes that I have left, just on some interesting passages in the Talmud regarding advice of investment. There's a passage in the Talmud in Bava Metzia, 42a. Rabbi Yitzchak said, one should split his money in three, one third in the ground, one third in merchandise, and one third in his hand. And what does this mean? So there are different approaches. I want to share one approach from the Maharshal, Rabbi Shmuel Edels, who was one of the great 16th century Polish Torah commentators. And he says as follows. It can also be explained as follows. One third of what he has should be used to acquire land. And each of these things has a particular advantage over the others. Okay, the reason he says, the reason why he's explaining this particular line is because the simple understanding of one third in the ground means hide one third of your money in the ground. This was back in the days when, the pre-secure home era. If you wanted your money to be safe, you hid it in the ground. But that is a simple understanding. The Maharshal says that doesn't mean bury one third of it in the ground. It means invest it in land. Invest one third of the money in land, one third in merchandise, and one third keep in your hand. And he explains, each of these things has an advantage over the others, because the third use for land, because they have achrayis. That's a Hebrew word. The word achrayis literally means responsibility. What it means is land is always there. The land is there. It's not going anywhere. For those who may be familiar with Lex Luthor's line in Superman, where he said, people will always need land. Stocks may rise and fall. People are no bleep good. But there's one thing they will always need. They will always need land. And so land is there and is a pretty consistent investment. I'm not saying you should go out to Eastern Colorado where it says one of those signs that says, land 25 cents an acre and go buy it up and hope that it goes up in value. But in terms of investing in land, he says that is a lower risk investment, for other assets can be lost in a moment. Okay, he's not talking about buying stocks, obviously, but buying merchandise. The merchandise can be lost, can be stolen. The ship can sink at sea and so on. But land is always there, it's lower risk. A third in merchandise, because even though merchandise is higher risk, but there's potential for greater profits. As we say later, 100 zuz in merchandise, meat and wine daily. Okay, that's what the Talmud says. In other words, what we call sechira, being a merchant, buy low, sell high, buy merchandise, it has potential for greater profits, and a third in hand to be available at all times for a sudden need. In other words, you want to make sure you have some cash on hand in case you have a need that arises. Don't sink all of your money into places where you won't be able to pull it out as soon as needed. So I think that this is a very, very basic manual of the Talmud for, as Adam discussed, diversification. Diversify your investments. You have some lower risk, you have some higher risk, and then you keep some funds in hand in case you need them for an emergency. Obviously, the stock market today, as we discussed, is a lot more complex than just one third in land, one third in merchandise. But the idea of diversification, of, like you said, the risk reward balance is here. Land is less likely to jump to very high prices, but at the same time, says the Maharshal, it's more secure. Merchandise has potential for greater profits, but also potential for greater loss, and keep some money in your hand as well. So that is the Maharshal's guide to investing money. And like you said, in terms of diversification, different levels of risk, different levels of profit. To end off over here in terms of throwing money away frivolously, so I want to share with you two more passages about spending money. And going back to the question that I mentioned earlier, if I am a multi-billionaire, which is not on the horizon anytime soon, but let us just suppose I have a lot of money to spend, is there a problem just frittering away that money or investing it in things for the fun of it or so on? So here's a passage from the Talmud in Chulin. And the Talmud says as follows. Rabbi Elazar said, Yaakov remained behind to retrieve small jugs. Those who are familiar with the story of Yaakov fighting with the angel, which is the angel of Esav, so the Torah says that Yaakov remained behind, and then he met the angel. And the Talmud says, why did he remain behind? So the Talmud says he went back to retrieve some small earthenware jugs he had forgotten. So the Talmud wants to know, one second, Yaakov, the Torah makes very clear, was a very rich man. He went back for a few small earthenware jugs. He went back on alone at night in the dark to get a few small jugs, put himself in danger. From here, we see that for the righteous, their money is more dear to them than their body. And why is this so? So that they not extend their hands into theft. Let me explain this passage quickly, briefly, it's late, but just what this is teaching us. This is not coming to say that one should be overly involved in one's money for money's sake. But the point that Talmud is making is that if God gave me something, I need to make sure I use it properly. I need to make sure I don't fritter it away or I'm not negligent in managing it. I take care of what I have properly. I invest it properly. I care for it properly. I manage it properly. The Talmud says that one of the great Talmudic sages, Rabbi Elazar ben Charsim, was an extremely wealthy individual, and he spent much of his time checking over his property, over his assets, to make sure that things were being managed properly. Why? Why? Because he said, if God gave me this money, I have an obligation to make sure it gets used properly. And if I fail to do so, it's akin to theft. Why? Because if you give me something and you tell me, I want you to do X, Y, Z with this money. If I give you $1,000 and I say, I'm giving you this $1,000 to invest, and you don't invest it, it just sits in your wallet. So then there's an element of theft over there. I gave you $1,000 to invest and you just take $1,000 and you put it in your wallet, or worse yet, you go and spend it at a casino somewhere or something like that. I didn't give you the money to be negligent, to fritter it away, to use it in a less than ideal fashion. I gave you that money to invest and to bring back dividends. So if God gave me assets, if God gave me money, I have an obligation to make sure it's used properly. And so when we talk about putting in the proper effort and so on, there's another element over here we have to consider. Besides my obligation of putting in effort to make a living, there's also a question of what does God expect me to do with this money? It might be appropriate for me to spend some money on entertainment sometimes so I can relax. And maybe we did a class once on gambling, as Adam mentioned before. You know, if you want to go to a casino, spend $1,000, or if you're Elon Musk, a lot more than that, and you have the money to kill, so why not? I'll tell you the why not. The why not is that's not an appropriate use of the money that Hashem gave you. I don't know if Elon Musk is coming to me for that kind of advice. And by the way, just for the record, despite his Jewish sounding first name, he's not Jewish. Just FYI. For what is apparently a frequently asked question. If one is blessed with assets and one is blessed with extra money, you have to figure out what is the appropriate way to spend that money. And that extends to how much charity should one give. The Talmud has limits on how much is appropriate to give for charity. One has that obligation. So the obligation is there to use that money properly. And so the argument could certainly be made that when it comes to due diligence, besides the obligation to put an effort to make a living, you also have that obligation to put in due diligence and not make risky investments. But I can afford it. So why not? Because if it's not appropriate, if it's not regarded as a reasonable investment, that is not using the property that you've been given, the property, the assets, the money that you've been given in the proper way. Just to conclude on that thought, on that note, with a passage from the great medieval Musar Sefer, Orchas Sadikim. One should not fritter away his money on frivolities. A person should be exacting with himself and be generous where it's proper to be generous. Where it's not proper to be generous, he should be miserly. Now, where should I be generous? Where should I be miserly? Everyone has to figure that out for themselves, what's appropriate and what's not. But the point he's making is, just because you have money doesn't mean you have to spend it. Doesn't mean you have to fritter it away or throw it away. Rather, it should be used properly. So, bottom line, just to summarize our conversation over here, the Talmud certainly encourages diversification. And Jewish thought, what we call hashkafa, the Jewish outlook is one does have to put in effort. How much effort? Depends which line of thought you take. Some will say, depends on your level of trust. Some will say, regardless, you have to put in a reasonable amount of effort. For most people today, we have to put in a reasonable amount of effort regardless. If you're investing in the market, or you're investing in Bordeaux, or Bitcoin, or bonds, you have to You have to consult. You have to do your homework. You should speak to an expert and to do the proper due diligence and to diversify. And lastly, keep in mind that besides the obligation to put in proper effort to make a living, we also have an obligation to put in our due diligence so that we are managing the property, the assets, the money that Hashem has given us, and we're not just being negligent with that money.